Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Healthcare Act and Severability Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 28, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Florida versus the Department of Health and Human Services and the National Federation of Independent Businesses versus Sebelius, two of the three cases before the court involving the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, sometimes referred to as Obamacare or the Health Care Act. Both cases raise the question whether, if the individual mandate requiring all Americans to obtain health insurance or pay a penalty is deemed unconstitutional, the remainder of the Health Care Act still survives. This is commonly referred to as a question of severability. Both cases further raise the question whether Congress can lawfully withhold federal Medicaid funds from states that do not comply with the requirements of the Health Care Act, or whether this amounts to unlawful coercion. That issue will be the subject of a separate podcast. To discuss the issue of severability, we have David Rivkin, who is a partner at Baker Hostetler, and Ian Milheiser, who is a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Mr. Rivkin.
The severability analysis is, of course, a part of a court's remedial inquiry to be undertaken if a major part of a statute is declared unconstitutional. What we're discussing here are the implications of the individual mandate being declared unconstitutional by the court, which I believe is going to happen. Now, the essence of a severability analysis is discerning of a legislative intent that's reflected in the statute. Now, in some circumstances, that can be a pretty easy task if the legislation has a fully fleshed out severability clause, which describes the congressional intent either to have the entire statute completely severable or completely non-severable. This, unfortunately, is not the case with Obamacare. Now, that makes the statutory intent analysis a much more challenging endeavor, as was demonstrated by this oral argument. The case law in this area is, I would say, a bit confusing in terms of precisely how you go about discerning legislative intent, and a number of justices approach this task differently. There is one theme on which everybody agrees, which is that you begin with a text. Now, fortunately, while Obamacare is lacking a severability clause, there are clear statutory indications of at least a portion of the statute when it comes to the severability, and that's something that was described during the oral argument on Wednesday as the core of a statute. The legislative findings in the statute itself indicated that individual mandate is essential for the insurance industry-related provisions, which are twofold: guaranteed issue and no individualized underwriting, which is to say no large differences in rates between the healthy and the sick, but both provisions are meant to work together. So, and this is also the case that the government has agreed that if individual mandate were to come down, the insurance industry-related provisions would come down as well. Now, the challengers, Paul Clement, have argued that the core of a statute actually is broader than that. He argued, in my view, absolutely correctly, that a number of other provisions, all of which are so integrally related to the, let's call it the inner core, individual mandate and the two insurance industry-related mandates. And that has to do with insurance exchanges, that has to do with employer mandates, and a fundamental revision of the Medicaid, that all of them have to come down together. There are several reasons for it. For example, the exchanges might be able to operate without the individual mandate and the insurance industry mandates, but they would not operate in the same way that Congress intended. And the reason for it is because the vision of exchanges that Congress had in mind is you need to have standardized insurance packages that would enable people to make reasonable choices. It would not work with the insurance policies as they exist today. The connection with Medicaid, of course, was if you don't have an individual mandate that drives people, that drives the demand side, the heart of a Medicaid change that's supposed to provide the supply for Medicaid would not make sense. So a large chunk of argument, of course, was taken then with a question of what constitutes a core. Frankly, it's a difficult question beyond, of course, the inner core type provision, which I mentioned. But that's still is an easier question than what do you do with the rest of a statute. And that has to do with, let's say, you remove either the core broadly construed of a narrow set of provisions, but there are thousands and thousands of pages, because remember it's a 2,700-word statute, which absolutely can work on their own without those core provisions. What do you do with them? And this is what prompted, probably in my view, the biggest debate in the court, with some justices preferring to use the salvaging approach, where you retain as much of a statute as possible, while the justice is suggesting that so much of a core provisions going down, if that would have happened, of course, the entire statute could come down. And sort of a philosophical question here is this. The old justices agreed that what is important here is to ensure that the judiciary is acting in a non-activist way that is most respectful of the two political branches. The question, of course, is what is more respectful, to take down the entire statute and therefore vitiate everything that legislature worked for, or retain a remnant of a statute that does not look like anything that the legislature passed? That is the difficult question. There was no clear sort of unity of views in the court. My personal view is this, and this is interesting. There's a normal presumption, of course, for severability. But that presumption has arisen in the context of cases where the provisions being taken down really are in the periphery of a given statute. What's unique about Obamacare is that the provisions we're talking about, to the extent they will go down, and I think they will, really, really are at the core of a statute. The court has never dealt with this issue. And in that situation, I think that the most responsible way for the judiciary to proceed is to take down the whole statute, because that would be most respectful of the prerogatives of the two political branches.
And now, Mr. Millhiser.
Well, I agree with several things that David said. I agree with him, first of all, that we begin with the legislative intent. I agree that the best way to determine the legislative intent is to begin with the text, and that the findings in this statute are very relevant to that intent. And I also agree with him that there are some difficult questions we've laid out here in terms of how much of the law is very closely related to the minimum coverage provision and how much of the law is further out from it. I'm not sure where this periphery versus core distinction comes from, because it has never, ever in the history of the United States been mentioned in a court case before. It seems to me that the question of what Congress thought was the most important part of a statute is a political question, which should not be answered by judges. There could be people who are very much in love with the enhanced research for medicine in this statute. There could be people in Congress who cared a great deal about the fact that their rural districts will have more physicians because of this statute. And I think it is getting into dangerous waters for the judges to take on a task that they are not competent to engage in, which is to figure out how important Congress would have deemed a particular provision of the statute. So that said, let's begin with what the cases have said. And what the cases have consistently said is that there's not just a presumption here, there's an unusually strong presumption. The most recent major case deal with it is probably the Free Enterprise Fund case, which said that the court must sustain the balance of the law unless it is evident that Congress would have preferred no law to some law. And I cannot think of another presumption in U.S. law, possibly strict scrutiny, but it is difficult to think of another presumption in U.S. law that is stronger than this presumption, which uses the word evident. So to the extent that there are difficult questions to be resolved, and the justices did have a great deal of uncertainty about certain provisions of the law yesterday, to the extent that they have uncertainty, they must resolve that uncertainty in favor of retaining provisions of the law, given the strength of this presumption. And there's also not that much need for uncertainty. And the reason why is because of something that David mentioned, and that's the legislative intent. So the Affordable Care Act says in its findings that only those provisions which ensure that, and this is a quote, health insurance products are guaranteed issue and do not exclude coverage of pre-existing conditions are linked to the minimum coverage provision. And that statement alone, that guaranteed issue and community rating are linked to the minimum coverage provision, should be enough to resolve the severability question. I can go all the way back to Marbury v. Madison, which said that affirmative words are often in their operation negative of other objects than those affirmed, to know that Congress's decision to specifically enumerate two things which are linked to the minimum coverage provision implies that things that are not enumerated were not intended to be linked. And even if that in and of itself weren't sufficient reason, again, we have this unusually strong presumption. It must be evident that Congress intended no law to some law if we're going to strike the whole thing down. It cannot be evident that when Congress explicitly chose just two provisions and excluded the rest of the statute in those findings, that Congress would have preferred nothing to something. Now, everything I've just said is moot, and here's why. The plaintiff's argument for why the whole law must fall, if you read the NFIB's brief, and David alluded to this, where he said that there are many, many provisions of the law that are so integrally related to the minimum coverage provision. So the NFIB brief spins out this incredible game where it tries to link as much of the law as possible to the minimum coverage provision. So first it says that the minimum coverage provision prevents the ACA's insurance regulations from, quote, making premiums in the individual insurance market prohibitively expensive. And then it brings in other provisions, says the subsidies in the law can't function right without it, says the employer regulations can't function right, says the exchanges cannot function right. And the problem with this argument is it turns their whole brief into one giant concession that the law is constitutional. Because, of course, in Gonzales v. Raich, the court said that when a provision of law is an essential part of a larger regulation of economic activity, it is a valid exercise of the Congress's necessary and proper power. So it concludes simply by thanking the plaintiffs for conceding that their entire case against the minimum coverage provision is nonsense, and I can't imagine any good reason why the justices should not credit their concession and uphold the law.
Well, let me begin with a last point, and one I'm intimately familiar, having been on the receiving end of the government's argument to that effect, which was delivered for the first time, of course, in their motion to dismiss in the district court, and I argued against it. Due respect to my colleague, this misconstrues the very modest reach of the Necessary and Proper Clause. The Necessary and Proper Clause is not, constitutionally speaking, a deus ex machina that's meant to save the workings of enumerated powers from producing disfavored results. The Necessary and Proper Clause, articulated particularly well in a case called Darby, has a far modest purpose. And that purpose is to prevent evasion, circumvention of the scheme set up, in this case, by the Commerce Clause. There's absolutely no evasion and circumvention possible on the part of insurance companies. We're not talking about a requirement to have books and records. The problem that the government was facing here is that if you do not have an individual mandate, the policy results of the insurance industry mandates would produce skyrocketing insurance premiums. By the way, they would not bankrupt the insurance companies, because insurance companies, there's no Nixon-style wage and price controls in the statute. The insurance companies would be able to increase their rates. Indeed, state commissioners operating the state law would be required to allow them to increase their rates to assure their actuarial soundness. But it would produce a bad political results for proponents of that law. It is only in that sense that the individual mandate is necessary. That's not what necessary means. Plus, the point that I think was made perfectly by Justice Scalia was the words necessary and proper come together in the Necessary and Proper Clause. And anything that vitiates state authority entirely by allowing the federal government to partake general police power cannot possibly be proper. So I'm not concerned about this concession. And the government's argument about this is going to fail. There's a difference, however, between the Necessary and Proper Clause in its constitutional dimension and the government's argument in the context of legislative findings, but they believe that the provision of the individual mandate is meant to work together with insurance industry mandates, and without it, the insurance industry mandates would not work as the Congress intended. It is only that they will not work, but the Congress intended, that's relevant here. It's not that those provisions cannot work at all. Now, leaving that aside, I would say that I agree with my colleague, at least as the analytical framework of his approach to severability. In almost all instances, you would indeed have this virtually impossible to overcome presumption, absent, of course, a clear severability link. The unique problem here is we're dealing with a statute that Congress saw fit to inform us. It's called Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. The very heart of the statute, the overarching purpose, was not to give more money to the Indian tribes or improve the state of research in blank lung. The overarching purpose was to provide for what the drafters of the statute believe would be measures to enhance insurance coverage and provide affordable care. Once you deal with the core provisions that are designed to accomplish that and they go down, the whole statute is bereft of not just any purpose as far as some of us are concerned, but the very purpose that Congress articulated. So it, to me, the fact that the Congress articulated its purpose with sufficient clarity and the core provisions, if it were to go down, as I believe they will, would deprive the remaining husk or shell, as Paul Clement called it, of a statute of any ability to perform those tasks, functions almost akin to a severability clause. It's like saying if enough provisions are taken down to render the statute incapable of fulfilling its stated purpose, we don't want the rest to survive.
So I'll take your points in order. I will start by rebutting Justice Scalia. I will then tell you why Justice Scalia is right about what judges should not do, and then I'll talk about the purpose of the law. So first of all, to get to the merits of the litigation for just a second, the rule under the Necessary and Proper Clause, stretching all the way back to Chief Justice Marshall, is that the clause applies to any exercise of power that is convenient or useful to the beneficial exercise. That was used most recently in Comstock, where the court upheld the detention of prisoners for sex offenses, or even not even for sex offenses, but for the future possibility of a sex offense, which is something that does not fall within the enumerated powers of the Constitution. And yet, because it was deemed convenient or useful to the beneficial exercise of other powers, that was sufficient. With respect to Scalia's substantive due proper argument, I'll simply say that it is not true that upholding this law would vitiate all limits on congressional power. The limits in Lopez and Morrison on entirely local laws and on laws which have no economic content remain in effect. So having thus dissed Justice Scalia, let me tell you what Justice Scalia has said that is very sound. He wrote an excellent book called A Matter of Interpretation, where he warned that if judges have the power to engage in infinitely fine distinctions, if they're allowed to say that this case is not like this case, for very minute reasons, if they're allowed to constantly play this game of distinguishing, then they become like legislators. You know, one of the most damaging ways to turn judges into lawmakers is to give them an infinite power to distinguish things. So I recognize that the law's opponents want to claim that this provision at issue here is so close to whatever the core of the statute is, that that might somehow distinguish it from every other precedent in the history of the United States. I just think it is dangerous for judges to play this game of saying that despite 200 years of history, we can create a special rule for one case, because if judges have that power, there's nothing that prevents the Supreme Court from forcing you to buy broccoli. Finally, to the question of the purpose of the statute. First, let me be honest about why the findings are in there and why they're in there. And second, let me offer a theory of statutory interpretation about them. The reason those findings are in there is because during the pendency of this bill, it became known that there was going to be a lawsuit filed challenging the minimum coverage provision. And so Congress decided to include a statement that would explain the reasons, or at least some of the reasons, why they passed this law, what the economic effects of the law are, how those economic effects relate to the goal of the statute, and why they think the law is constitutional. And they did that because Lopez and Morrison stated that there is some help given when those two constitutional case, if those findings exist. In terms of a theory of overarching statutory interpretation, those findings should not be read as findings describing the purpose of the entire bill. It is not the case that every provision in the law, including reauthorizations of long-existing programs, including programs that have to do with cost savings and that have to do with things that are unrelated to making health coverage affordable, it is not true that those findings apply to the whole law. Those apply to Title I of the law, which includes the minimum coverage provision, the insurance regulations, and the subsidy. And there are many things in the law which are both very, very important and which are relevant to that purpose. There are provisions to make Medicare more affordable. There are provisions to improve doctors' ability to rely on reliable research so that they can treat their patients more effectively. As I said before, there are provisions that help rural areas have more health providers. In some counties in this country, there are not any health providers. There are provisions to give more opportunities to nurses. There are a number of provisions which were related to the overall goal of improving the health system, have nothing to do with the goals stated in Title I. And I don't think that should be taken that Congress passed those provisions superfluously. They put them in there for a reason, and the court should honor it.
Let me indicate that we're in strong accord on one issue. I, too, agree that the reason there is an explicit reference in legislative findings to the connection between the individual mandate and insurance industry mandate is because they understood that the challenge was coming, and having been utterly reckless in how this legislation was drafted before, have decided to lay a possible foundation for making a necessary and proper clause argument. The irony here, of course, is that if it's improvident for judiciary to look beyond indications in the statutory text as what congressional intent was and try to discern the true motivations of the legislators, we should not be able to do in this context any more than in other contexts. But what frankly interests me the most is, of course, the necessary and proper clause argument, and I'll make the same observation about it that I made with some success, at least as far as persuading Judge Vinson in the district court. My point was that if you begin with Marshall's language to which my colleague has alluded, the last few words in the relevant passage, if not mistaken, emphasize that they have to be proper. The use of necessary and proper clause cannot result in a fundamental distortion of our constitutional architecture. Any situation where you can use the necessary and proper clause in order to straighten out disharmonious, unfortunate, or dysfunctional policy-wise consequences of using enumerated power would give the federal government general police power. The way I illustrated was to point out that all you have to do under this version of kind of necessary and proper clause is to pass a very ambitious statute. I called it something like the Happiness, Prosperity, and Peace Act of 2011. That was 4 years ago, we can say of 2013. Have a couple of feeble regulatory provisions based upon enumerated powers that fall demonstrably short of accomplishing those results. And presto pronto, you then use the necessary and proper clause to put in place a variety of mandates that would call for Americans to exercise, to do wellness visits, preventive health care, smart savings, judicious career choices that would cure the deficit, that regulatory gap between the use of enumerated powers, and that cannot possibly be. The other way of looking at it, to respect your interpretation of what Lopez and Morrison stands for, utterly trivializes those cases. Yes, there is a different language there concerning local impacts, but that is not the true holding of those cases. The true holding of most cases is that there has to be a meaningful, judicially enforceable principle that distinguishes between the use of enumerated powers, which fundamentally never work on individuals as such. They operate only on material objects, on things, on instrumentalities and activities, and reach people only insofar as and to the extent that they engage in those activities, they touch those things, they manipulate those objects, they use those instrumentalities. And general police power, which only the states have, which reaches people as such. And the distinguishing characteristic, of course, is you cannot escape general police power. It attaches to you simply because you exist. The only way to escape is to die. With regard to enumerated powers, you can always escape All you have to do in order to escape regulation of wheat or marijuana is not to touch either, and you are free. The individual mandate can only be supported by general police power. That is why, if you were to support this either by the Commerce Clause or Commerce Clause is augmented by the Necessary and Proper Clause, federal government is exercising general police power, the vertical separation of powers is dead, and we don't have the same constitution.
Well, we could go on forever, so I will be very brief and just make two closing points. One is I will start with very close to what I began with, which is to remind, with respect to severability, there is such a strong presumption in favor of retaining the law. David, you've given a plausible theory for how the law and its findings can be interpreted. So have I. And given the presumption that applies here, we have to resolve this uncertainty in favor of retaining as much of the law as possible. Finally, I agree with you completely that there has to be meaningful, judicially enforceable principles that courts apply, which is why I find this substantive due proper theory so disturbing. Among other things, it is unclear to me how the word proper provides any guidance whatsoever to judges. And so for those people who are bothered by how the words liberty in the 14th Amendment carries the weight that it does, I don't understand why they would glom on so quickly to a substantive due proper analysis. Finally, with respect to this claim that Congress cannot fix problems created by its own statute, that once again is rebutted by the Comstock case. The reasoning of the Comstock case, the reason why the government was allowed to detain prisoners who were deemed sexually dangerous individuals beyond the length of their sentences, is because the court felt that by bringing these individuals into a local community and putting them into a prison there, they would then be released into that local community unless the government had created a danger and the government, pursuant to the necessary and proper power, could cure the danger that it had created.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.